Today's Teshel will be on case 72 in the Book of Serenity, Zhongyi's Monkey. Introduction, a battle of wits across a river, holding the army, concealing the troops. Face to face, they face each other, the spear of reality, the sword of truth. That is why patch-robed monks esteem the great function of the whole potential. From relaxation into urgency, try to spit it out in the open. Yongshan asked Zhongyi, "What is the meaning of Buddha nature?" Zhongyi said, "I'll tell you a simile. It's like putting a monkey in a room with six windows. When somebody outside calls it Simeon, Simeon, the monkey then responds. In this way, when called through all six windows, it responds." Yongshan said, "What about when the monkey is asleep?" Zhongyi got right down from his seat, grabbed and held Yongshan, and said, "Simeon, Simeon, you and I see each other." Verse, freezing sleep in a snowy room, the year about ended. The recondite ivy gate does not open at night. Groves and forests withered in the cold. Look at the changing conditions. The spring's wind blowing stirs the ashes in the pipe. A really good koan like that one makes no sense at all. And that's really great. When you read a koan like that, it's so confusing and so disorienting. It really resists interpretation. You know, you say, monk Simeon is a monkey, he's looking through six windows, you know. What could this be? You know, the monkey's asleep. You know, that's so weird. The thing is just weird, you know. And that's a really good koan, because you know, you can try to figure it out. So there's six windows. So what could that mean? What could the six windows mean? I think, well, looking at a window, you know, windows. Monkey, what a monkey, what a monkey. Let's start with monkey, you know, windows isn't working out. There's five senses, six windows, you know, what could that mean, you know? One, five, six minus five. It's all one. That's it. It's all one. monkey. You know, monkey. Oh yeah, monkey mind. I remember that. You know, the monkey mind. And yeah, so this idea has something to do with the monkey mind, of course. There's a teaching in early in the Pali Sutras where the Buddha says that. You know, the mind, untrained mind, is like a monkey. You know, basically, this is quite interesting, you know, this simile in the sutra, because it is true, right? I mean, if you watch your mind during a day, you realize that it is a bit like a monkey. You know, monkeys are famous for having short attention spans, you know, so... you know, a monkey, I was reading once about a monkey will pick something up, like a chimp, will pick something up and it'll be fascinated, and then something else will catch its attention, and if somebody tries to take it away, it'll even fight, you know. So it'll find something, and it'll be intrigued, and if somebody tries to take it, they'll fight him off, you know, and you screech and fight and claw, And then, you know, like they'll turn around and see something else interesting. Like one minute they have a piece of fruit and they're holding it, or a fruit husk or something, and it's interesting. And then they fight, and then they win, and they have the fruit husk. And then they turn around, there's like a piece of coconut on the ground, you know. And then they drop the fruit husk and pick up the coconut. And it's so absorbing, you know. And the monkey's forgotten all about the fruit husk, you know. And this even happens, sometimes they'll carry it for miles, you know. They'll, you know, go through the trees with this thing in their one hand, and then they find something else interesting, and they just drop it, you know. And the Buddha said, you know, this is actually, human consciousness is just like this. You know, we laugh when you read something like that about monkeys, it's so funny, right? You know, you think, what stupid jerks, you know? I mean, they find something and then they forget, you know? But we're just like that, you know? Absolutely, right? I mean, if you watch the mind, you'll notice that, you know, one minute we're thinking about something obsessively, and then all of a sudden something else catches our attention, and then we think of something else, and this goes on all day. And it can go on in our lives too. You know, people can have interests and they just keep turning over their interests, you know, and moving on to this, moving on to that, and one day it's, you know, a person wants to learn how to sail, the next day it's yoga, you know. So actually, you know, the Buddha said the mind is really like this crazy monkey, and it sees this, and then it sees this, and it can't stay focused on the moment long enough to really be aware of things. You know, that's the original teaching. So anyway, it's possible that this koan with the monkey and the six windows and everything has something to do with that, you know. But if you try to work it out, you know, the Buddha didn't talk about six windows, he didn't talk about another monkey, he didn't talk about the monkey going to sleep. So it's a little puzzling, right? And, you know, a good koan is not really susceptible to being figured out. So whenever you find yourself treating koans metaphorically or in terms of interpretation, you know you're doing the wrong thing, okay? So whenever you think that you're, whenever you're approaching a koan and you're thinking, this is like, there's a lesson here that I have to learn and I just need to interpret it, right? Now, when I was in high school, I learned how to interpret things, you know? So, there's a famous poem by Robert Frost called The Road Not Taken, right? And it's about coming to a fork in a road and taking one fork and not taking the other fork. And the person in the poem basically says, what would have happened in my life if I had taken the other fork? You know, that missed opportunity. And when you read the poem, you realize he doesn't really spell it out like the way I just did. You know, Frost doesn't. It's really just about traveling on a road and not taking one fork. But when you read it, you think, of course, this isn't just about traveling on a road. This is about not, you know, choices we make in life, you know. And then you start thinking of all the choices you made and all the consequences that followed from those choices, and you might think of all the missed opportunities. You know, why didn't I? And at the end of it, you might feel very stirred, very moved, and like you've come away with some kind of insight. Now, I'm not knocking that. You know, I myself read poetry, and I love poetry, you know, which does that. You read it, and you come away thinking, oh, you know, that's very deep, you know. But it's really not deep, not in the Zen sense. It's just an intellectual interpretation. Now, you know, ideas have, like, resonance. They can be very stirring, you know. And poets are very good at that. You know, they're very good at appealing to you on many different levels, not just the intellectual level, but on an emotional level too. But koans don't really work like that, you know. And when you find yourself interpreting a koan, please realize you're probably not processing it properly. So a koan really requires like a different kind of processing. You have to use a different part of your mind, and it's not really the part of the mind that operates so strongly when you read poetry. You have to sit with the koan, and you have to watch your breath and go into like this blank state, and you interpret, or rather you internalize some part of the koan. Usually every koan has a key phrase or a key element. And in this case, it could just be monkey, right? You could just say, you know the story, and you could just say on each out-breath, monkey, 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 or actually better would be simian, 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 okay? And you might think, this is insane, right? I mean, how could I ever get anywhere with this? But you can process information on a deeper level than your discriminating mind. And it's a different kind of intelligence, you know. In the modern world, we don't put a lot of stress on this, you know. In ancient times, people were much more aware, much more open to the unconscious than they are now. They didn't really distinguish between the conscious mind and the unconscious mind. Even in the Buddhist, even in the Pali Sutras, this is true. So after the Buddha's enlightenment, a god appears to the Buddha named Sahampati. And in the Buddhist world, in the Buddhist cosmos, there are many different kinds of gods. There's many different heavens, there's many different hells, and there's many different gods and demons or hell beings at various levels, and it's all very confusing. At any rate, there's an intermediate heaven, and after the Buddha has his enlightenment, a god named Sahampati shows up and says to the Buddha, well, the Buddha, after his enlightenment, he said, oh my God, you know, things are totally different than people think. See, after his enlightenment, it was just like, holy smokes, you know, nothing is the way it seems. And the Buddha says, actually, in one of the Pali Sutras, he says, you know, if I try to tell anybody, they'll never believe me. They'll just never believe me. And he realizes this is so contrary to what people think is true. You know, most people think, you know, that most people don't, you know, they think the self is real, they think the world is made of matter, etc., etc. And the Buddha just realized that my awakened understanding is so different from this that it's incommunicable. But then this god named Sahampati comes and says, listen, Lord Buddha, please don't think that way. The world is a miserable place right now, and it needs your help. And if you just try to teach this, people will hear and respond. And then the Buddha says, okay, I'll do it. And he sets off for the rest of his life tirelessly helping people. And so for the rest of his life, after he agrees with Sahampati, he doesn't give up right to the very end of his life. And every spare minute he's helping other people. The point is, I think this reflects a mind of the time where people didn't really distinguish between their unconscious and their conscious minds. You know, we don't necessarily experience the unconscious mind very directly anymore. except like when we're dreaming, right? But in a normal waking at the moment, we don't experience like beings appearing in front of us, you know, except if we're having like a psychotic breakdown. But I think people in ancient times maybe did, because their door between the unconscious and the conscious was more open. And so it was very difficult for them to distinguish between like something that was appearing in their minds from the unconscious, and something that was present in the conscious mind. Even as a kid, I actually had that problem too. Many children have this problem. It was very hard for me to distinguish reality from a dreaming at sometimes. And my mother would go, "Weren't you dreaming?" And I would be generally confused about that, you know, because things would happen to me when I went to bed, and when I would get up, it was hard for me to decide if, like, I remember telling my mother once that, you know, there was like a stairway in the closet, because I had dreamed that. And she would go, "Now, you know, aren't you dreaming that?" And then I'd realize, "Oh yes, I'm dreaming." That wasn't. And we'd go look in the closet, and there was no stairway, and I would be disappointed. But for a little while, it was hard for me to distinguish. And in fact, I remember my mother took me to see Sleeping Beauty. And Sleeping Beauty is about this woman who eats an apple and falls asleep in a trance, and a prince has to come and wake her up. It's a pre-feminist fairy tale. So she's asleep without her prince, see, that's the point. And every princess needs a prince to kiss her and wake her up and start her living. Right? I wrote some feminist fairy tales to counter this one when I was a young man. But anyway, there's an evil stepmother in here who won't let, who puts Sleeping Beauty to sleep so she won't become a fully developed human being. And puts her in a glass case. Isn't that it? Am I getting this right? Or am I mixing this up with Snow White? I can't remember. But anyway, the point is, there's a witch in there, and she's terrifying, at least for me. When my mother took me to the movie, and I was so convinced that witch was real. And I remember I would wake up at night, and I would look around the room, and I could see her, you know, and I'd grab the covers and pull them over my head and just sit there shivering, you know. Yeah. Little kids are like this, you know. I think that it's hard sometimes for little kids to distinguish between what's sort of like an unconscious memory or a dream and reality, you know. And I think that people in ancient times were like that too, you know. Now we have a different mental world altogether, you know. In other words, we live mostly in consciousness, almost 100% of the time, unless we're asleep. And the unconscious is really quite remote, in my opinion. And so, you know, all day long we're doing things which are, you know, require thinking, power, and we're very self-motivated, right? Every once in a while, we're stirred by things, you know, on a deeper level. At a baseball game, everybody stands up and recites the Pledge of Allegiance. And you've recited it 100,000 times, right? But every once in a while, you can start reciting it, and it's like, wow, this is very moving, you know? And you think, why is that so moving? Well, why is it so moving? See, it's hard for us to explain this, you know. But on a deeper, unconscious level, something is activated, you know. And we're quite ignorant about this. We don't pay any attention to this dimension. But sometimes there's a stirring deep inside ourselves, and we don't know why, but it's producing a kind of like energy or a feeling of a resonance, you know. And it's often missing, you know, because we live so much in the conscious mind. You know, And sometimes, you know, generally the conscious mind is like, is very, is basically thinking, how can I make something happen, or, and generally, how can I make something happen for me, right? So the conscious mind is like very self-centered, and it's very manipulative. It wants to have things happen. So all day long we're planning to make things happen in some way, and this could be very good. I mean, just before the session, Barbara, my wife, came home and found her dad, who's 90 years old, on the floor. This was like the night before session, and Jack had, for those of you who remember a previous Teisho in which I introduced my father-in-law, this is the man. I came home one night and he was sitting naked in his chair holding his Sharps rifle, his unloaded Sharps rifle, and he had fallen asleep with the rifle in his hand. He is a 90-year-old retired design engineer and sportsman and gun fan, and he's a lovely human being. But anyway, he has has two gin, what do you call it, martinis at the end of every day as a reward for being 90 years old. And he loses his balance. We think this is what happened. And anyway, Barbara came home and he had fallen down. He was cold on the floor, and there was blood everywhere. He cut his head, and we had to take him to JFK and so on and so on. So, there was a good doctor there and good nurses, and they took care of him. They stitched up his head. They did a EKG. I'm sorry, they did a CAT scan. And in fact, they did three CAT scans. They did other things too. But, you know, when we came to visit him, I went to visit him around 3 on Tuesday, 3 in the afternoon. He was grumpy, but he was doing okay, you know. The doctor who fixed, the people who fixed him up, you know, they had this kind of conscious mind that we've gotten so good at using, right? You know, they fixed him up, he was patched up and he was functioning, and the little screen was, showing his heart rate and his blood pressure and everything, and all the lines looked the way they should look. Barbara brought him some gun magazines so he could read those. So the thing is, I'm glad we've really made miracles with the conscious mind, you know. Really, miracles. But on the other hand, it's an interesting aspect of modern life that things can become lifeless, you know. You could be a doctor, and you could go to a hospital, and you could be helping people all day, but you might feel that your work is quite meaningless, you know, and you might feel quite stale and lifeless. You know, this happens to people all the time. It's a fascinating problem. You know, a lot of people are just dragging through life, you know. There's a fair number of people who are terrified, and they're just being chased through life by fear. And the culture encourages that, right? I mean, a lot of people are deeply in debt. They're just working in their jobs because they need the money. You know, they're afraid the boss is going to fire them. You know, so those people have a very difficult life, right? And they're just trying to stay one step ahead of the debt collector. Every day they go to work and they think, please let me not find a pink slip on my desk, you know. I remember talking to a woman in the ShopRite in Piscataway who has two jobs. And I just thought, oh, you poor dear, you know. You know, she works probably a long day at ShopRite and then she has some other job just to pay the bills, you know. So that's one way to live. And then there are people who have you know, every appreciable security, but when they go to work, it's all sort of like meaningless and drab. And both of these people can have like problems with like, it's like you feel, you just feel there's no energy in life, or there's no, you know, it's just like meaningless or lifeless, you know. When I was young, when I was a kid, on television, they used to sell a product called Geritol. And Geritol was a vitamin tonic. You know, America was just discovering vitamins. And it would always say, are you tired and run down? You know, you need some Geritol, you know. And it would have some guy with droopy eyes, and, you know, he'd take a tablespoon, and then the screen would show time changing, right? And then you'd see his face, and it was bright, and his eyes were animated, you know. This is actually quite, this, you know, the product did well because lots of people feel tired and run down, even if their lives are not particularly extraordinarily demanding. It's like there's a kind of lifelessness to things. And when we talk about that state, we often call it meaninglessness. We say, oh, life is so, it seems so meaningless to me. You know, I'm just going to go to my job for the next 30 years you know, I just put in my time, I'm punching the clock, you know. And this is a common, very common situation for people. Have you ever wondered why that is, you know? It's fascinating that, you know, some experiences, you know, you can be, you can get out of your car, you can walk into your house 100 times, and you don't even remember doing it. And then one day, you get out of your car and you start walking to your house, and you feel wonderful. And maybe you suddenly look at the trees around your house and you feel like, it's like a door in yourself opens up, or like you start humming inside. Why does that happen? You know, something is stirring, you know, something causes us to stir, maybe. But on the other hand, you've come out of your house, you know, 100, you've come out of your car 100 times. And it was just like, oh yeah, home again, you know, you've got the groceries. It's like, oh, give me the strength, you know, and you grab the groceries and you drag them in the house. The cats want to be fed as usual, you know. So, you know, but one time, maybe out of 100, something is stirring you, right? And you think, where does that come from? And I think modern people are so ignorant of themselves that they don't understand. They don't, may not, you know, they just go, huh, that's odd. You know, if they even think about it, it's like, that was neat, you know. But why does it happen? You know, why is life so lifeless sometime and so full of life at other times? And this can take other forms too, you know. You could go to, you know, the first time I went to the Grand Canyon was just an amazing experience, you know. I had seen pictures of the Grand Canyon when I was a kid in westerns, you know. And when I got to the Grand Canyon, it was an extraordinary place, you know. I remember walking down the Grand Canyon, and halfway down, there's a place where you can get water. It's a little flat area, a little plateau. And you can get water there, and you can rest, and a lot of hikers rest there. And there's, the Grand Canyon is not what you might think. It's the trail down to the river is filled with people. It's like a hiker superhighway. And there's also mule trains that go down with tourists on the mules. And so, you know, it's like you really have to keep moving. But halfway down the trail, there was a guy playing a flute. And the flute music was resonating up the sound of the up the walls of the canyon, you know. And he's a good flautist. It was really good music. And it was just like, you know, the breezes were very warm and the cottonwood trees, the leaves were shimmering in the wind, and this beautiful music was coming. And it was like so powerful. I almost wanted to cry. Another time, I remember I was in graduate school, and I was very ground down. This is my first year of graduate school, and I was trying so hard and getting not very good grades. I remember not getting the best grade on my first paper, and I wasn't feeling well. I didn't know at the time, but I had worms. I had been in Mexico for a long time, and I had picked up roundworms. And I didn't know it, but I lost a lot of weight, and I was tired, you know, all the time. And I tried Geritol, and it didn't work, or something like Geritol. You know. I was really down and worn out. And I remember going to this performance of Indian music. This is not from the subcontinent, but Native American music. And I was standing there with my wife, and these Indians started singing this music, which is quite unlike Western music. You know, they have big drums, and they beat the drums, and they chant with very, the men have a deep, and the women go, they go up and down, and it's very haunting, you know. And when I just heard the music, and the tears were pouring down my face, and it was like my whole insides emptied out, and the tears were just rolling down my face. It just shocked me, you know, where is this coming from? But we have this deeper life, this deeper mind, and we live on like the, it's like we live on the surface of our lives. And as I say, you know, we keep saying that my life seems so meaningless, but the problem is not meaning. It's not like if you could just interpret your life better, you'd feel okay. See, that's why interpretation is so shallow. You know, it's not about interpreting. It's not a problem of meaning. Meaning is just ideas. It's about connecting. See, when we live on that little mind, we feel so disconnected, not only from ourselves, but from the world. The little mind is all about making distinctions and analyzing and manipulating things from the standpoint of a small self. So it's inescapably alienated. But the big mind, we have this unconscious mind, which is deeply connected to the world. You come out of the house and you smell the rotting leaves of autumn, and you hear the wind, the last leaves blowing in the trees, and you can smell that, you know, that sweet smell of decaying leaves. It's just so beautiful, and it's just all of a sudden you just feel such joy welling up in you. There's no intellectual content. There's no lesson to be learned, right? I mean, you could say, I should appreciate my life, you know? But that's just baloney, you know? That's not why you feel better. You can't really say why you feel better, but you feel much better. It's because you're now connecting with things on a deeper level. It's the unconscious connection, see? And the little mind is like always the last to know, you know? He goes, huh? Oh, yeah, I'm happy. What do you know? You know, but it doesn't know why. You know, this is the Zen life, right? It's like this is about, like, you know, people go to school, they go to college, and they study microbiology, or they study literature, or they study, and these are all noble undertakings and are very essential. But on the other hand, we don't go to any school that teaches us how to be intelligent with the big mind, right? How to use, you spend 12 years in an American educational situation, you spend 12 years in elementary, intermediate, and high school. And then you go to college and you may spend another 9 or 10 years. So you spend, what is that? You spend 22 years sitting behind a desk learning how to use your discriminating mind. But you never go to school and learn how to use your big mind, right? And yet, you know, the big mind is so important, you know. It's so important, and it can provide extraordinary happiness and a deep sense of connectedness to things. So Zen, you could think of this is like school for your big mind, you know. And of course, like this can be like kindergarten. We really have like one schoolhouse here. This is like an old, in America there used to be something called a little red schoolhouse, right? In little towns used to have a little one schoolhouse for the whole community. And you'd have kids who couldn't read yet. You'd have big kids who were in the 12th grade, and they'd all be in the same room, and the teacher would be trying to teach all these people. You know, that's kind of how the Zendo is. You have beginners, you have people who are in graduate school, you know, basically in the same room. And it's good, actually, mixing people up like that is very good. You know, basically this is like the little red Zen house, you know. And we're learning how to use the big mind. And it's not easy, you know, because first of all, we don't know how to use it, right? It's like in Harry Potter when they have the wands and they're trying to make something happen, and nothing happens, you know, whatever he says, they're trying to make an elephant appear and something else appears or something, you know, it's kind of like that, you know, but little by little you become adept at tapping into your unconscious. And it's not like you suddenly understand your unconscious in an intellectual way. That's never going to happen. It's like a door opens up between you and your unconscious. And of course, the unconscious itself has many layers, you know. So there's a lot of junk in there that you have to get through. You can't. The top layers of the unconscious are not trustworthy. You know, every once in a while you'll hear about some guy who has a religious revelation, right? And he'll be praying, and the voice of God will say, "Take your family and go out into the Utah desert, you know, and take many wives, and so on and so on." And the guy will go out there, and he'll set up this place, and he'll have wives from 42 to 12, you know, and the police will arrest him. But God told me to do it, you know. How did this guy go so wrong? You know, he trusted his unconscious, actually, and it spoke to him, you know. It was like Sahampati appearing, you know. But he didn't know how to get to the deeper, he didn't know how to clean it up, and he didn't know how to get to the core of it, which you can trust, you know. So there's all these layers of the unconscious, and they're not reliable, you know. You have to work down through all this karma. This is what happens to you on the cushion, by the way. You know, you sit down, you stop thinking, and you think, okay, now I will use my Zen powers, right? But instead, you're thinking about, you know, these fragments of thoughts are coming up, or problems with your relationship, or, you know, emotional turmoil, or reliving things that happened to you as a kid, or, you know, things like that, Beatles songs, you know, that would be before your time, but Green Day songs. you know, that's all down there. But, you know, we keep cleaning it up. It's like you clean up the karma that's stored there, and you get to like a pure mind, a Buddha mind, which has no characteristics. It's like water. Right? It's pure like water. It's clear, odorless, tasteless, and yet we're floating in it. And this is the core mind. I mean, enlightenment could be described as reaching that mind. And basically, it becomes much easier to tap into your big mind. And the ideal thing in Zen is to let... Right now, you know, in the modern world, people live like this. They have a gigantic little mind. You know, it's like the discriminating mind is hugely powerful, right? And the unconscious mind is filled with all this junk, and they really have this puny little unconscious mind. The proper way to live, according to Zen, is a balance. So you need like a well-developed unconscious mind as well as a well-developed conscious mind. And we're hopelessly out of balance, and so our culture is very destructive and insane almost. Like, even though, see, that's a crazy thing, you know. Our culture is very rational and very very logical and very highly technically sophisticated, but we use our powers for the stupidest things, you know. It's like a billion people go to sleep every night hungry. A billion. That's true. I'm not exaggerating. And yet, you know, for most people, their biggest concern is like a new car or a bigger house, and the reason is that they're driven by these motives that are not really, you know, they're concerned about their status in the community. They you know, people have houses so big, they've done studies of usage of house space, and they find many houses they're hardly ever occupied. There's whole areas of a modern house, especially here in New Jersey, where they build these gigantic houses, you know. People aren't even in there. They're in there like 10% of the day, if that, you know. So strangely, we're very unintelligent, even though we have all of this intelligence. And on the other hand, you know, we have this kind of discriminating intelligence, which is a great achievement. But we're not in. I shouldn't have said on the other hand. We have this discriminating intelligence, which is hugely well developed. But we're unintelligent on a deeper level, and so our life is very destructive. And so, you know, I think Zen is quite important. We've got to find that balance. We've got to live a whole, you know, you can't really connect with the world with the discriminating mind. You can't. You need the other mind to connect, and then you can be a truly intelligent person, right? Otherwise, it's like we have like an, this is not, I don't mean to cause anybody any offense, right? But we have like an Asperger's society, right? It's like Asperger's, these are people who have no, they're just all calculating mind. They have no deeper life. And it's just like they're just a brain that doesn't have an unconscious almost, you know? And they might have tremendous power, but they're strangely unalive, you know? But this is the whole society's like this, you know? We don't want to be like Asperger society. It's very important for us to have two minds in balance. So, that's what we're doing here today. Now, what about the monkey? Well, I'm out of time, so I can't. But really, this koan, in a strange way, is about what I was just talking about. I'm not going to explain it, but someday we'll do the koan. But believe, trust me, you know. I'll give you a in the Pali Sutra, the mind is like a monkey, and that's a bad thing, right? But, you know, actually, being a monkey is A-okay with me, being a simian, you know what I mean? I mean, being a human is rough, being a monkey is A-okay, you know? Because, monkey is natural being, right? When a monkey wants it to eat, it eats. You know, when a monkey doesn't like something, it takes some of its feces and it throws it at you, you know? So watch out, you know? In India, there's a being called Hanuman. Hanuman, monkey god. And in the Ramayana, Hanuman helps save Sita from Ravana. And this is a symbol of the power of natural being, right? That we need to tap into this natural energy in order to rescue that what is best in ourselves. See? So Ravana is a demon who steals Sita, takes her to Sri Lanka, and she has to be rescued. Very beautiful story. And the hero, the hero has to have help, and he has help among other creatures from Hanuman, and also from other animals. Isn't that interesting? The bears also help, and other animals. And what this means is that we need to tap into these powers of in ourselves, which are like the powers of the natural world, in which we can only reach through the unconscious and save Sita. So, exciting, don't you think? So being a monkey is a-okay. Yeah. You can leap right over the water from India to Sri Lanka.